It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Today marks the one-year anniversary of singer Michael Jackson's death. Radio stations across the country are playing the King of Pop's greatest hits. The renewed interest in Jackson's work has improved the finances of his estate, which had become a tangled mess in the last years of his life. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
If there's any place that illustrates Michael Jackson's shifting status, it's Amoeba Records, an iconic music shop on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. Daniel Torres remembers what Amoeba's Michael Jackson stock looked like before Jackson's death last June.
We had this huge pile of old Michael Jackson stuff that wasn't really selling. There was this one gigantic box set they did that was like every single thing he'd ever recorded. I forget what the thing is called, and we had a whole pile of these things that we had ordered a couple years ago that never sold, and they were just sitting in the corner.
But Torres says everything changed the day Jackson died.
We just put everything we had out, and every single copy of everything good just sold within an hour.
It's cynical to say it, but death can be a very good career move.
Steve Pond is a writer for TheWrap.com, an online daily that covers the entertainment industry.
I mean, Michael Jackson's estate has apparently made about $1 billion in the year since his death.
It's a posthumous comeback that restored Jackson to the powerful peak he enjoyed in the 80s when he revived the flagging music industry with mega hit albums like Off the Wall and this. Jackson made a huge amount of money, but he also spent a large amount, which got him into serious debt. Bill Wordy, editor of Billboard magazine, says Jackson's death, tragedy that it was, had the odd benefit of fixing his financial problems.
Not only does it spur an incredible amount of interest in that artist, which of course drives sales and other revenue opportunities, but it also removes the spending from the estate in a big way.
It's happened with other artists, most famously this guy. Elvis was high up on Forbes magazine's Dead Celebrities earnings list for years, but Jackson placed ahead of him last year. Bill Wordy.
He made some very shrewd investments in his life. It's pretty well known that he has a 50% stake in the Sony ATV catalog, which has rights to the Beatles songs. His estate owns his own song catalog, which not many artists have the chance to do.
This is it. Here I stand.
With the re-release of old favorites and the unveiling of the hit documentary This Is It, featuring his last rehearsal, Jackson's estate is making plenty of money to pay the bills. Billboard's Bill Wordy says if managed properly, Jackson's children Paris, Prince, and Blanket won't have to worry about saving up for college.
Not only would his children not have to worry about college tuition, but his children's children and probably their children won't have to worry about college tuition.
Formidable. Or, as the man himself might put it, Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
More coverage of Michael Jackson at NPR.org.
It has been a year to the day since music icon Michael Jackson died. You might even remember what you were doing last June 25th when you heard the shocking news that the 50-year-old King of Pop was dead. Michael Jackson will be remembered for releasing the biggest-selling album of all time, Thriller. And good or bad, he'll also be remembered for the personal struggles that stemmed from his family life, addictions, and legal problems. From the memorial service in Los Angeles, here is Reverend Al Sharpton.
I first met Michael around 1970, Black Expo. And from that day, as a cute kid, to this moment, he never gave up dreaming. It was that dream that changed culture all over the world.
As we look back at Michael Jackson 1 year later, are we closer to finding out who he really was or who he wasn't? I'm joined by Shay Earhart. She was an editor who worked with Michael Jackson very closely on his official autobiography, Moonwalk. Shay, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Tony. Nice to be here.
So it's been a year. What do you make of what has happened to our understanding of Michael Jackson in this last year?
The interesting thing that I think that's happened in the year since he died, and it happened almost immediately after he died, was people began to reevaluate what a musical genius Michael Jackson was. All of his backlist, his albums went to number one. People were in absolute awe of the genius of this man, and I think it was easy to have that forgotten when what was in the headlines were, you know, just the tabloid nonsense. And so that's really been a valuable aspect of this last year.
Berry Gordy, in the prologue to the reissue of the book Moonwalk, talks about the fact that Michael Jackson had this public persona as a performer unparalleled, but that he had these other quirks, you might say. Talk about those as you experienced them dealing with him and writing his autobiography.
I personally never saw anything quirky or odd about Michael. You know, Michael was full of fun. He was somebody who loved to have a good time, loved to play practical jokes on people, and loved to laugh. He was incredibly intelligent. He was reading all the time. He was always carrying a book around with him that he had words underlined. He had comments of his own in the margins, because he was just so crazy about learning and about knowledge. And he was fascinated by entertainers who had come before him, entertainers who were, you know, his contemporaries. And he was a very interesting man. But I never saw anything or heard anything that would give any resonance to any of the headlines that many people hung on.
Well, there certainly was a lot to talk about there. You could even, no pun intended, write a book about it. But let me ask you about this, because his estate, since his death, has amassed $1 billion, that's with a B, $1 billion. That includes album sales, television and movie projects like This Is It, the documentary. There were other projects. How do you explain that phenomenon?
Well, I think that when Michael was alive and was at the height of his career with, say, Thriller and Bad, that he was making that kind of money. And so I actually think that, again, it was that, you know, resurgence of interest in Michael, people realizing, my God, you know, the music is unbelievable. I have to have this album. I have to see this movie. I want to have Michael Jackson firmly in my life. And that's what has generated that money. And, you know, good for the estate and, you know, good for Michael and his heirs.
How does his legacy, in your opinion, Shay, compare to other music icons like Elvis or John Lennon or Selena or even Kurt Cobain?
I mean, it's very difficult to compare apples and oranges. I mean, I think Michael was a profoundly fine musician, an incredible songwriter, singer, performer. He just had it all. You know, when Michael Jackson walked on stage, you could not take your eyes off him. And he was so dedicated to his fans and to his audience. It mattered so very much to him that he go out there and that he give them his all.
As we end the conversation, what song do you think we should go out on?
Oh, that's so hard. I think you should go out on Billie Jean.
Shay Earhart was one of the editors who worked with Michael Jackson on his autobiography, Moonwalk. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Shay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tony.
I've written about Michael Jackson on the Tell Me More blog. He was the star of the best concert I ever saw, Motown 25. I was there. And we've got guest blogs from people who interviewed and worked with Jackson. Also at the blog, you'll find Tell Me More's usual Backtalk segment, where we highlight the backtalk we hear from you. You can find both at npr.org. Click on the program's page for Tell Me More and blog it out.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Bertie Baker is a beautiful and ambitious woman who uses her derriere to get ahead in Hollywood. You can take that phrase in all ways. She ran out on her life in a small town in Virginia, where she had a nice husband, close family, active church, to go to Hollywood, where she struggled and strived for 9 years. But so far, her best gig has been to have her derriere double for the backside of a Hollywood star. She auditions almost every day. Once in a while, she gets a line in a commercial. The way Bertie Baker tries to handle the guilt of leaving her family, her desire to get ahead, frustration, and loneliness is all at the heart of Jenny Hollowell's new book, her first novel, Everything Lovely, Effortless, Safe. Jenny Hollowell joins us from NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know this territory, both professionally and personally, don't you?
I do. I grew up in a very religious family. We were Jehovah's Witnesses. So that aspect is certainly personal. And then I've also worked as a producer for TV commercials for the past 10 years. So I've had a lot of exposure to that world, been sitting through a lot of auditions with actors who are very hopeful, mm-hmm. trying to get the part. And so I've seen sort of that struggle take place in front of me as well.
In this novel, Bertie, well, she has a lot of reasons to be mortified from her point of view. She's at her age, which I guess is what, about 29?
Yes, 29 or 30.
She's still house-sitting.
Yep.
In the guest house of a very successful, wealthy producer. She is the she's the derriere of of a better-known star. And then when she gets a good offer, it's for a tampon commercial.
Yes. She has had a series of disappointments. And it's funny how the things that feel like victories at first begin to feel like disappointments. I'm sure the first commercial role, there was a big celebration. You know, that's an exciting thing to happen. But after 9 years and still being a body double, still getting those one lines, I think she certainly had hoped for more.
She feels some guilt for leaving her husband, Judah, who just seems in the early chapter like an awfully nice guy, but not enough to keep her in small-town Virginia.
It's true. Well, she seems certainly like a person who didn't examine the reasons for marrying him very closely before actually doing it.
He really did understand her.
I think so. And I think, you know, I mean, it's hard to say why people do what they do, but I think in my mind the reason she left had less to do with him and more to do with herself. I mean, I know it sounds sort of like it's not you, it's me kind of thing, but you know, he was a nice and decent man, but she certainly was ambitious, and the nature of their life and their marriage was not going to fulfill whatever it was that she felt like she needed to do.
One day, Bertie meets a beautiful and beguiling young actor, Louis.
Yes.
She thinks a guy that good, she can't be any good for him.
I think that he has this realness, and I'm saying real sort of with air quotes in a very Hollywood way. He has a realness that she has sort of been known for, and I think maybe is a little afraid of losing, mm-hmm. because she's been in Hollywood for an awfully long time. So not, you know, I don't think she's completely aware of how she's in some ways a vampire in his life, you know, trying to suck out some of that realness for herself.
People outside of Hollywood think of Hollywood, understandably, some of the concentration, a lot of the concentration is on major names, recognizable stars, kind of people who have to wear sunglasses to avoid being recognized.
That's right.
This is a Hollywood novel you write about, well, is it a Hollywood novel? It's set in Hollywood, and you write it about the kind of people who stand close enough to Harrison Ford or Katy Perry in a Starbucks line to touch them, but feel that they're in a separate universe.
Yes. You know, I think that is one of the strange and difficult things about living in Los Angeles, if you are an actor. I'm not an actor, but I'm, you know, I am a person living in Los Angeles, and it's bizarre the proximity you have to very famous people sometimes. And I think, you know, being an actor in this city, you do have this proximity to the people who are doing what it is that you want to do. You are literally this close to what it is that you want, and for it to remain unattainable would really be maddening.
Am I wrong reading this book to infer that you make some kind of link between faith and show business? You know, let us celebrate the mystery of creation.
I think you're right about that. I think that it's something that really sort of fascinated me. I was having trouble understanding how this could be, how we could, as a sort of American culture, be obsessed with celebrity to the degree that we are, but also be in this period of real sort of religious fervor. From an outside viewpoint, it seems sort of contradictory, but I think that the promises of celebrity in many ways mirror the promises of religion. The idea of being special and remembered, and that's a really human sort of desire. And whether you're acting that out in your religious faith in trying to build a real relationship with God, or whether you're a very ambitious, you know, young person standing in line at a reality show, you're still trying to be seen and to be remembered in some way.
Jenny Hollowell, your new novel, Everything Lovely, Effortless, Safe. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We live in a time where we expect to see extraordinary things before our eyes. Spaceships streaking between stars, dinosaurs returning to life, whole planets blossoming with beautiful blue people. So how do you expect to impress people just by sawing someone in half or picking the ace of spades out of a deck of cards? But magic can still enthrall us. Anyone with an interest in what must be the world's oldest other profession might want to schedule a visit to the Conjuring Arts Research Center. It's a small, dark library in the shadow of the Empire State Building in New York City, crammed to the rafters with personal letters from magicians and books on magic that predate Columbus. William Kalush is the founder of the center. He says magic goes way, way back.
What's the oldest thing we know about?
Yeah.
There's an Egyptian papyrus in the Berlin Museum that tells a story of a magician named Didi of Desdenefru doing an effect for King Cheops, of the great, famous for building the Great Pyramid. And he does a thing where he takes an animal and decapitates it and takes its head. I think he used a duck, and shows that its head's over here and the body's over here, and he puts them back together, and the duck is perfectly fine and
wow.
goes on to live.
Wow.
And I've heard academics talk about this papyrus, and they say, well, no, these are fairy tales. But I know as a magician, this can be done.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we created a method to do this, and then actually performed this a few years back on a television show, and it really just looks like that. It looks like you've taken a chicken, we use the chicken, taken its head off, here's its head, here's its body, and you put it back together. And now put that 5,000 years ago. This papyrus is about 2,500 BC, so it's pretty close to 5,000 years old.
Yeah.
So that's the earliest, but then there's a big gap, and we start getting stories about magicians performing things that we would recognize again about the time of Christ, about the first century AD. And then books start to be written telling mm-hmm. secrets, and there's some really good things that we could still use as magicians today that were written 2,000 years ago.
Like what?
Well, what can I tell you without tipping too much? There are ways to read minds that are 2,000 years old that still work. There are methods to take your hands in front of the entire audience without any sort of covering, take a pot of oil, put it on a fire. When it starts to boil, you put your hands in the oil, take them out.
Yeah.
They're fine. Now you throw the vegetables in, which start to cook, and you can make dinner. And this is a method that's still great and would still fool anybody today, yet it's 2,000 years old.
You've done that?
I haven't done it personally. Right. I would, though. I mean, we've thought about it.
This is something like
this
Jamie Oliver should do on a show.
This could absolutely be done.
I don't want Nigella to harm herself. But in any event, I don't want Jamie Oliver to harm himself either. But in any event.
But then there's a jump again, and then when books start happening. Now, there's lots of record of books, of non-printed books. If you'd like to go into the rare book room.
Yeah, please.
I'll show you some of the things that we've managed to collect here.
Okay.
It's a little bit warm, but I'm not going to turn the air on because of
this place is beautiful.
Thank you.
And a huge show posters here of, if I knew my conjurers a little better, I'd...
Well, there's Carmi, buried alive for 32 days. Actually was an American, wasn't Indian at all, professed to be an Indian. Sanis, who had, now this is in the 30s, would memorize well in excess of 100,000 telephone numbers. The books, this is where we keep all the books printed and the manuscript books before 1900. And the earliest complete book we have, originally it was written in about 1280. Mm-hmm. The first time it was printed was in the 1470s. This example's from about 1480. Mm. And it was printed in Rome, and it's in Latin. And this particular book is attributed to Albertus Magnus. He's now a saint, but he wrote about a lot of interesting things. And in this book, he writes about secrets, mm-hmm. and one of which is how to take a dead fly mm-hmm. and resuscitate it, bring it back to life. And here it is, written in the 13th century and printed in the 15th century.
Now, if I asked you, how do you resuscitate a dead fly, would it be against the code for you to tell me?
I wouldn't tell you, no. I might tell you the path you might take to go find that method yourself. For example, I've already told you that it's somewhere in this book in medieval Latin. You might be able to find a copy of this book someplace and find somebody who can translate it and then tell you what the method is. I wouldn't mind helping you find the method, but I wouldn't want to just tell you the method, because what we're doing here is teaching more than just exposing secrets.
Show a man how to do a magic trick and he does a magic trick for a day. Teach him how to do a magic trick and he does magic for life.
Right. Entertain him for an hour, or teach him how to entertain for the rest of his life. One of the things we do here is we have an outreach program where we send professional magicians into hospitals, and they teach kids in hospitals, kids in community centers, and also kids in detention centers, how to do magic. Mm-hmm. And it's really not about physical therapy. It's really about mental therapy. It's about the ability to project yourself and to show a little initiative and build self-esteem.
But I'm interested in this, because the whole like with a kid is considered to be at risk. He mm-hmm. or she learns how to do a series of magic tricks, and it lifts their
Absolutely.
Definition of themselves.
Absolutely. It's all about feeling like you've got some power over your own life, because it's not just about performing tricks. We don't like that word trick. And, you know, sometimes magicians use it, but I think it's the wrong word. Yeah. I think that it's really about an effect and about a performance and about magic. And so what we teach these children and the veterans is about having a power. And the power is maybe I can read minds. Maybe I want to have the power to put a solid object through a solid object. And so we create a small set of powers and let the kids choose what power they want to have. It's pretty exciting.
There's so much that we can look at now, and for that matter, youngsters are growing up with now, that seems like magic, that we know is done by special effects, and it's done by computer graphics, and it just, I mean, you see astonishing things. Whole worlds are created that way. Has that made it rougher for magic, conjuring?
I think, to be honest, it's a great question. I'm glad you asked. And I think that it's made it not rougher. I think it's actually opened the door even wider for us. Because one of the reasons it's special is because from my perspective, a great performance of magic always involves the audience. Mm-hmm. Whether they pick this card, or whether they choose this, or when it's a mind-reading effect, what have I done with this, and what am I thinking? These are all things that affect the outcome of the show. So the audience becomes integral. And I think because of that factor, as long as magicians continue to use that, all of this technology, whether it's in film, whether it's the iPad, which looks like magic to me, I don't think it's going to affect the performer.
What's the importance of keeping conjuring going?
Well, I think a day without wonder is really a terrible day. I think that what keeps people, what keeps science moving forward, what keeps our human spirit is curiosity and wonder. And I think that as magicians, what we can do when the performer is accomplished, we can give you a peek into what a world would look like if magic were real. I think that if we can allow our audience to feel like there's real wonder and magic in the world, then we've done our job.
Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Nice talking to you. Thanks for all
this was wonderful.
William Kalush, founder of the Conjuring Arts Research Center in New York. We have nothing up our sleeve. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.